eliminated Obamacare's unfair individual mandate, which punished young Americans like you for the privilege of not buying bad health insurance. That's really what it was. You had the privilege of not buying, and you had to pay for it. Not too good, so we got rid of it. That was a big deal. That was one of the most unpopular things anywhere or on any subject.
President Donald Trump at a campaign rally earlier this week in Arizona. Well, last night, in a legal brief filed with the Supreme Court, his administration argued that ending that tax penalty means the entire health care law should be tossed out. Just as millions of newly unemployed Americans have signed up for it, enrollments are up nearly 50% this year. Joining us to talk about the future of Obamacare is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi.
Well, first, talk about the last-minute nature of this. This brief was filed just before the deadline. Was there a debate inside the administration as to whether this should have been filed at all?
I don't think so. I mean, they have been saying, you know, for a year now that they want Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act overturned. It's not a great political look for them, so it frankly wasn't a big surprise to me that they filed this in the dark of night, 11 o'clock to be precise, with a midnight deadline set by the court. So I had a late night, but I wasn't surprised.
Or an early morning. So you weren't surprised, and yet here we are in the middle of a pandemic, as I just mentioned. It is an election year. What are the political optics of doing this right now?
Not good. And even Republicans say so. Earlier this week, I interviewed a Republican strategist who specializes in health policy. And he said to me, it's pretty dumb to be talking about how we need to repeal Obamacare in the middle of a pandemic. Let's not forget that millions of people have lost their jobs, and along with those job losses have lost their health insurance in this pandemic. So the number of uninsured Americans is just going up.
So what is their argument, the administration's argument?
The argument is that when Congress in 2017 zeroed out the tax penalty, the so-called individual mandate that required Americans to buy insurance or face a tax, that Congress rendered the law unconstitutional because it could no longer be justified under Congress's taxing power. But I think it's important to remember that repealing Obamacare has been a stated goal of Republicans for 10 years since the law was enacted and signed into law by President Barack Obama, and President Trump campaigned on it. They weren't able to do it legislatively. You might remember it failed in the Senate. John McCain dramatically came in and gave it the thumbs down, and so they weren't able to get the repeal bill through the Senate, so they're trying it in the courts.
But previously, the Supreme Court has upheld it.
The Supreme Court has previously upheld most parts of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. In the very beginning, the law required all states to expand Medicaid, the government insurance program for the poor. The court found that Congress could not require all states to do that. So that actually was a big hit to the law. But overall, the law has survived and it's remained in place, and it's really become an integral part of the nation's healthcare system.
Right. And so how is it viewed now amongst Republican voters and amongst the administration's base? Do they use it? Do they like it? Or do they hate it as much as their representatives say they do?
Well, everybody loves its central protection, which is the protection for people with pre-existing conditions. So when Republicans say they're going to get rid of it, they always say, no, no, but we're going to keep, you know, we're going to keep covering people with pre-existing conditions. They just never explain how they're going to do that. Nationally, polls have showed that public opinion has actually been pretty divided over this law ever since it was enacted. The Kaiser Family Foundation tracks public opinion of it. And I believe it's a slight majority approve of the law, and it does break along party lines. Democrats tend to be in favor. Republicans, and especially President Trump's base, tend to be against.
Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi, I believe, has unveiled her plan to increase it. And what does that look like?
Well, the speaker wants to expand access and lower costs. So among the provisions in her plan is that nobody would pay more than 8.5% of their income for health insurance. The plan would offer a path to insurance coverage for pregnant women who are not insured for a year after they give birth. It would do a number of other things to lower drug costs. It would allow the government to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies. One thing that it would not do, or it does not look like, is Medicare for all, and it will not have a public option, the option for a people to buy into a government-run insurance program, which is very popular among Democrats.
Right. Well, I wonder, in a kind of an odd way, if the Supreme Court does ultimately side with the Republicans and the states who are suing to overturn or get rid of Obamacare, states led by Texas, if the Supreme Court agrees with them and invalidates the law, if that doesn't give people a lot more reason to push for universal health care coverage, single-payer style?
I don't know. I think that the argument that Republicans have made against single-payer health care is that it's socialism. And I do think that that argument still really resonates with Americans, even though Medicare is essentially single-payer care for people older than 65, and nobody has a problem with Medicare. But nonetheless, the way it's been messaged is useful for people who are not fans of Medicare for All. So I kind of feel like the Medicare for All debate was in a way really settled in the Democratic primary. Democrats rejected it. They rejected the candidate who was espousing it, Bernie Sanders, and they, you know, embraced Joe Biden, who was never going to advocate for Medicare for All. So I'm not sure, but I don't want to predict, you know, who knows what would happen if the court overturns Obamacare.
Well, I guess you can be fairly certain that Democrats will campaign on this particular issue leading up to the November election.
Yes, they will. And they already are. Democrats won the House majority based on their promise to expand access to health care and to lower costs. And that argument is just all the more resonant now in the middle of a pandemic. And a lot of people are worried that if they get COVID-19, that they will have a pre-existing condition. And then what will they do? So it was no accident to me that Nancy Pelosi announced her health plan this week on Wednesday, with the Trump administration due to file its brief on Thursday. And the House will vote on her plan Monday.
Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how are professional baseball and basketball teams going to resume play next month in Florida? The Sklar Brothers are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you heard our show on Wednesday, we talked a lot about how schools didn't really ace distance learning. Students were disengaged, teaching was spotty, technology not the best. All reasons why students should go back to school in person this fall, and there are more, according to my next guest. Joseph Allen is at Harvard School of Public Health, where he's the director of the Healthy Buildings Program. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, you argue that students should go back to school for those reasons, that the distance learning was iffy, but also there are more. What are your other reasons?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot more reasons. And I think anytime we have this conversation about schools and school closures, we have to talk about just the devastating consequences at an individual and societal level from school closures. First, we're creating virtual dropouts. I'm in Boston, and for example, in our Boston public high schools, 10,000 students didn't log in at all in May. Philadelphia, similar problem, younger age group. In elementary schools, only 50% made daily contact. We also know that when students are not at school, they're more sedentary, so that has implications for physical and cardiovascular health. Over 30 million kids rely on schools for nutrition. So there are a lot of reasons we have to be concerned with before we make that decision to say, well, let's close, keep schools closed for a long time. And I'd say on the flip side of that, we can talk about that more, is that there's a positive here in that we know how to reduce risk in schools.
Okay, so let's get into that. How do we do that? And let's begin with K through 12.
Sure. You know, first, kids have lower risk. They're less likely to catch it. They have less bad outcomes. So we're very fortunate there. But the proven risk reduction strategies work for all ages. And let me start by talking about what's happening in hospitals, where hospitals have largely gotten risk to healthcare workers under control by following the basics, things we've all heard so far. Wear a mask, wash hands frequently, and importantly, make sure you're doing the right things with the building. So let me start with buildings, because that's something that we should start in right now. You have to prioritize bringing in more fresh outdoor air, and that'll depend on whether or not you have a mechanical system, HVAC system, or you have a natural ventilation system, which means opening up the windows. You want to increase and maximize the amount of outdoor air. Any air that's recirculated, you want to move to higher efficiency filters, specifically a MERV 13 or higher, MERV, MERV 13 or higher. And then you can think about supplementing that with portable air purifiers. And for fixed locations, we can add in places where you could put in plexiglass dividers, for example, at the reception desk or the cashier at the lunch counter. So there's a lot we can actually be doing with our buildings, including making sure our bathroom exhaust fans are functioning properly. But these aren't strategies that you can jump into in late August as you're preparing for school to come back. Schools need to start looking at their systems right now to understand what can and can't be done and mm-hmm. what kind of slick strategies can be put in place that don't cost a lot to bring in a bit more fresh outdoor air.
So what about behavior? That is the key. And it's a lot harder to control a six-year-old's behavior wearing masks and keeping distant from one another than it is to control a college student's behavior. So how do you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the greatest challenge. I think we're all aware of that. I have three kids. I fully understand that challenge. You know, in the classroom, we do want to wear masks. On the school bus, wear a mask. In common areas, hallways, wear a mask. Wash hands frequently. Watch your distance, right? The three W's. Wear a mask, wash hands, watch distance. We know that's going to be hard in terms of a compliance standpoint. So what we need to do is build in mask breaks, acknowledging that kids aren't going to be wearing these things or are going to be really hard. And how do you do that? Well, masks can come off when they're outside, have downtime, reading time only, and no talking time, so they're not emitting as many aerosols. I also think we have to build in the difference between physical distancing and group distancing, recognizing that compliance in a classroom for longer periods of time won't be as effective. So you want to maintain physical distancing. You also want to try and separate classes as much as possible so that if you have a case in a class and it starts to spread through a class, it doesn't become explosive and spread through the entire school. So we encourage group distancing as well as much as possible. And the real thing that needs to be done, the biggest, the most important recommendation is that schools have to establish a culture of health, safety, and shared responsibility. We have to change the way we've done it. I recognize we know kids have a hard time complying with a lot of these things. We have to change the culture so that it becomes, this is what must be done if we're going to mm-hmm. get through this and have kids in school.
Do you think there needs to be a mix of distance learning and in-person learning and just have fewer people on campus at any given time?
Well, I've seen those strategies, you know, AB days, AB weeks, and I don't think they work for maybe what might be an obvious reason is that let's give the example of a teacher who has a student, their own kids, and that their child is in another school, maybe in that district or a different district. What happens when their child has an off day and they're home? Well, that teacher won't be able to teach in the classroom she or he are working in. And it creates all these discontinuities that make it a real problem. I think the better approach is to put in these really stringent risk reduction strategies, have teachers focus on in-classroom teaching. At the same time, we propose a strategy where at the district level, a parallel remote learning option is happening, recognizing that there will be some students who are immunocompromised, won't be able to have in-class learning. Some students will get sick. Some will have to self-quarantine. And you're going to need a parallel remote learning option that's happening. We like the idea of having a reserve corps of teachers, newly retirees or newly minted trainees who run these in parallel so that the in-classroom teachers can focus on in-classroom teaching. Now, it won't be perfect because the lectures won't be perfectly synced, but nothing is perfect about this pandemic. It's all less bad options at this point. But the idea being that if students are home, they do have a pathway to at least have some remote learning happening.
So bottom line, you're saying that you can reduce the risk to an acceptable level, and it's just far better in terms of public health for students to be back in school if they can mitigate these risks and take on some of these recommendations.
Yeah, there's no question that the cost to not having kids in school is just massive and will have lifelong effects. I'm a parent. I understand the reluctance or the anxiety. At the same time, we have to place that against the value of in-person education and knowing what the science says in terms of risk reduction. That doesn't mean everybody just rushes back to school at business as usual like 2019. 2020 in schools has to look a lot different. And a lot different means this culture of health, safety, and shared responsibility. We should throw everything we have at this. We need to layer the defenses, recognizing that there's no one strategy alone. We need to share that responsibility. There's no one person who should be responsible, not the principal, not the superintendent. It's parents, students, teachers, administrators, everyone involved. We need to limit transmission chains by encouraging that group distancing so we don't have explosive outbreaks. And we also need to be really flexible. I mean, the science is changing daily. So whatever plan we put in place today, it will likely be different or have to be modified come August and September. And very last, we have to ensure equity here and recognize the immense challenges that some in society face and the disproportionate burden that school closures put on many people.
Joseph Allen is a professor of exposure assessment science and director of the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard University School of Public Health. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Madeline. I enjoyed the conversation.
It's time for sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Yeah, well, maybe not so many cheering crowds these days. Professional baseball and basketball are resuming next month. Opening day for baseball tentatively set for July 24th, for the NBA, July 30th. But the NBA is training in Florida, where there has been an explosion in coronavirus cases. Nearly 9,000 new cases just today. Of course, that is a record. 16 NBA players have tested positive this week. Let's talk about all this now with the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. Hi, you guys.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
Well, I am fine, but what is happening with the NBA? They are set to begin training in Florida next week. Is that actually going to happen?
I mean, is anything going to happen is the question. It's like, that's the plan. The plan is that they're going to go to Florida. But I mean, is Florida still going to be a part of the United States and not just break away and go off into the ether? I can't answer that question, Madeline.
No, but there is an attempt. And I think their goal is to create a bubble where their players can safely, in a sense, like as a league, quarantine and get through these playoffs. And that's the goal and that's the hope. And obviously we'll wait to see if that's successful.
So the plan is what? That all the teams gather in Florida and they stay there until the end of the season, which is now set for October 13th.
Right. And they're going to play a few. It's not all the teams. It's just the top teams and the teams that are in contention for the playoffs. And they're going to play a few weeks to just determine who are the top eight teams in each division. And so that they will then go and then start the playoffs. I mean, they're trying to, those are almost like ramping up. I'm nervous about players getting injured because they haven't been playing games. You know what I mean? This is the type of thing that you're going from 0 to 100 miles an hour so quickly. So there's going to be a lot of managing people and workloads and whatnot. But it's, they're trying everything they can. If any league can do it, I feel like the NBA can do it. They're such a nimble league. They're very smart about the way they do things. They're very socially conscious. So I feel like if anybody's going to read the tea leaves and make a call even at the last minute on how, and alter things, the NBA is more of that league. So they want to play some regular season games, then get to the playoffs. And for LA, Jay, you and I were talking about this. I mean, this is this was a mad, other than the tragic, tragic news of Kobe Bryant's death, this is a banner year for LA basketball because you had two teams that could have potentially gone to the finals, right, Jay?
Absolutely. And you had a chance, you know, for obviously the Lakers have been there before, but for long-suffering Clippers fans, this was ostensibly the year that they could have gone certainly farther than they've ever gone before and possibly to the finals. And we believe the West is stronger than the East, even though Milwaukee's a great team coming out of perhaps the East. The Clippers had a real shot this year if they could get past the Lakers to win it all. And so I think fans of the Clippers and fans of teams that were in contention are just itching and hoping that somehow they can eke out this season.
So they're both teams are going to Orlando.
Yes. If they do manage to get through the playoffs, whoever wins, you have to look at it in terms of this, because Jay and I were talking about this. There are players who are not going to go. There are players whose teams are going to go down there, but for whatever reason, maybe they have a spouse that has underlying conditions and they don't even want to potentially bring Corona back into their house, or their parents live with them and there's a threat of bringing it back and potentially infecting them. So there are some players that are not, even though their teams are going down, they are sitting out. You know, you have to look at it and view it like players were injured. You know, last year, Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson, both of the Golden State Warriors, two of the best players on the Golden State Warriors, both got injured and couldn't play in the finals. And Toronto won the NBA Finals. That's not, no one's taking anything away from Toronto because sometimes players get injured. You have to look at coronavirus and players' decisions to sit out or not like injuries.
Do they get paid if they decide not to play?
That, I think, is determined by each team. But I'm sure that those guys make enough money that they would say, you don't have to pay me for this shortened season. They got paid already for what they played of the season so far, but maybe they would forego the rest of that. If you're a good owner, you would pay your player anyway for being conscientious.
Okay, let's turn to baseball. There will be a truncated season, just announced, 60 games. Opening day, maybe July 24th. What can you tell us about that?
Maybe. And if you're a Dodgers fan, they just came out in Las Vegas with sort of the odds. They do what's called an over-under, where they guess how many games out of 60 that the Dodgers will win. And the Dodgers were picked to win the most games out of any team in both leagues, and their over and under is set at 37. So the prediction is that they'll win 37 and lose 23, which if you were to extrapolate that out to a 162-game season, that would be like winning 100 games, which is a very good year. The team wins 100 games, that's an unbelievable year. So, you know, the people are saying that's the Yankees and the Dodgers. The Yankees in the American League, the Dodgers. Yankees are at 36.5. But it's an exciting time, as you know, Jay, as you can explain, in terms of what baseball is going to do with this 60-game sprint and the things they're going to try in this season.
Yeah, they're going to definitely try to address some of the criticisms that baseball is too boring, that extra inning games go on too long. They're implementing new rules. Number one, there's going to be a designated hitter in both leagues. That was an American League thing. And now they're talking about adding a situation in extra innings, because a lot of people say, well, a 6-hour game is just too long. A 5-hour game is too long. So to add excitement, they're going to put a runner on second base in extra innings, already starting with a runner on second, which in baseball is considered in scoring position. So they're adding exciting elements. First of all, 60 games in a season. Every game counts now in a different way than 162-game schedule would make it. So the excitement that could build around baseball this year, and you think about all the sports, think about the contact in all the sports. In the NBA, there's physical contact. In the NFL, there's obviously a lot of physical contact. Baseball is one of those sports, you know, like golf, where, you know, or tennis, where there, you know, there can be distance. Obviously, when a runner's on base.
But aren't they sharing the ball? And and when a runner, doesn't he have to be tagged out?
Yeah, he's tagged out by a ball in a glove. So again, you're doing it in such a way of like you interact with the people at Whole Foods more than someone getting tagged out.
I like how they decided they banned the most disgusting parts of baseball, the spitting of tobacco and sunflower seeds. That's part of the
reason. Yeah, just spitting is weird. It's just to walk around in a dugout filled with just other people's saliva. No one ever really examined that. That's disgusting. And also, you know, it's just basically you're putting cancer in your mouth, putting tobacco, chewing tobacco in your mouth. That's not a great example.
It's a win-win for everyone, this ban.
That could be, again, maybe this situation brings about positive change in certain ways.
Well, I'll give an analogy, as Jay was saying, as far as the DH, because it's important to know. Here's an analogy. Pitchers, it's like, pitchers hitting is like asking your plumber to fix your TV. Yes, he or she might be able to do it, but don't count on it.
Okay. Number one in my book is no more spitting.
No more spitting.
Okay. Randy and Jason Sklar, they never spit. They're called the Sklar Brothers, and their podcast is View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, how to make the perfect salad.
You know, what you're interested is in all the different salamis and cheeses, the olives, but I think it's also important to pay attention to the quality of greens. And then, of course, you want a nice punchy vinaigrette.
The best salads there are. Evan Kleinman is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, you know by now, that means it's time for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment. This summer, with hotter temperatures, you might want to avoid the oven and have a salad for dinner. Evan Kleinman has a few tips on where to get good to-go salads, and she's going to give you a dressing recipe of her own. Hi, Evan.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, you asked listeners about their favorite salads in Los Angeles, and so what are they telling you? Where is the best takeout?
Well, first of all, we have to identify what kind of salad. So I asked about big salads.
What's a big salad? Like a meal salad, not a side salad.
Yeah, giant bowl. Not a composed salad. A lot of modern salads in restaurants that we know and love are composed. Everything lying flat on a plate and you kind of eat a little bit of this and that. No, I'm looking for a large quantity in a bowl that's crunchy and tons of texture, good dressing.
Yes. You have me. I like that. Okay. And did you get a lot of response?
A lot of responses. And of course, they fall into various categories. So there's the chopped salad, which everybody loves. That usually consists of some kind of lettuce material, usually some garbanzo beans. And then it's kind of like a hero, the insides of a hero sandwich chopped up and mixed with lettuce. So the originator of this salad is La Scala. And theirs is still great. But an alum of La Scala, Emilio, opened a place in Encino called, funnily enough, Emilio's. And some people say his is even better.
Mm.
But then there's also Nancy's chopped salad at Pizzeria Mozza, which is famous. And the one at Cosa Buona.
That one is delicious. I've had that one. What makes a good chopped salad?
a good chopped salad is having respect for the kind of greens. I mean, a lot of times greens can be an afterthought because, you know, what you're interested is in all the different salamis and cheeses, the olives, pickled onions maybe, or nice crisp raw onions. But I think it's also important to pay attention to the quality of greens. And then, of course, you want a nice punchy vinaigrette.
Yes, definitely a punchy vinaigrette. So what about some of the other categories?
One of my favorite is the cob, and
which it's sort of a cousin to the chop, isn't it?
It's a cousin to the chop, but it is not Italian focused. So the cob is much more protein intensive. You have the egg. You usually have turkey or chicken, some bacon, maybe some blue cheese.
None of this sounds low-cal, just saying.
Oh, no. No, we're not talking about salad as penitence. We're talking about a big salad.
Okay, big salad, big calories, go for it.
So my favorite cob salad actually is at the Grill on the Alley, the original grill in Beverly Hills. I just think that it's beautifully put together and so delicious. There's also a humongous one that I haven't actually tasted, but listeners pointed it out to me at Aroma in Studio City. Avocado is heavily represented in that one, so how could it be bad?
Mm-hmm.
Then yeah, the next indeed. Category is the Chinese chicken salad.
Yum.
Yeah, I love them too. So a lot of folks love Feast from the East in Westwood. That was my mother's favorite place. But Jones on Third also has a huge following.
Hmm. Yeah, I've had that one. That one's good too. Do you like the wontons or not? The fried wontons in it.
Oh, if there's no fried wontons, what are you even doing eating that salad? just have a chicken Caesar and have it be over with.
Well, it's a sesame vinaigrette is really good. I like that too.
I don't know. Yeah, but I mean, it's all about those wontons.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Again, not a low-cal meal, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. So the Mideastern version of these big salads would be fattoush, which is the salad that is greens, often arugula, tomato, cucumber, sometimes dill, and pita chips. With a good dressing. There's a great one at Carousel. And then we go into the papaya salad world, which is a different world.
Wow, it's endless.
Papaya salad is different, though, because it has that whole thing of being tart, just a tiny hint of sweetness. If it's the Northern Isan style, there's a great deal of funk from either brined crabs or maybe this chunky, funky condiment made from fermented river fish. And it's interesting, when you do shoutouts like this, there is definitely consensus. So the two places people loved that version is from Lum Kanad in Reseda and Song Fung Kong in North Hollywood.
All right. So what if you want to make your salad at home?
So I grew up with a mother who did not believe that you had actually eaten dinner if you didn't have a big salad. And big salad meant at least two kinds of greens, cucumber, carrot, and then a wild card. Who knows what? Bean sprouts, whatever. Something else crunchy. And the dressing was always the same. And it's the dressing that I ended up serving at my restaurant for years that I renamed the Forte dressing, meaning strong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a garlicky Parmesan dressing, and I'm sharing the recipe with everybody. It's a huge amount of garlic that you put through a garlic press, which makes the garlic super spicy, very peppery. And then a nice hit of a good red wine vinegar, good olive oil, and a handful of Parmesan cheese. Now, I should say growing up, my
and
mother
salt,
made...
of course.
Of course, salt. And I love it with pepper, too. Growing up, my mother made this dressing with Wesson oil, Kraft shake cheese.
That's Paco in the background there.
Yeah,
I think he's snorting his approval.
He loves that dressing, actually.
Of course he does. All right. We are going to have that recipe for your dressing as well as the list of where to get all these salads up at KCRW.com. Evan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Coming up, should you see Jon Stewart's new movie? Christy Lemire and Justin Chang review new movies next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Not ready to start going back out on Fridays? Well, that's probably a good thing. Maybe a movie at home is in order tonight. Joining us to talk about a few new movies is Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Welcome back, Christy.
Hello. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you. Also joining us is Justin Chang, film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to you, Justin.
Thank you, Madeline. So good to be here.
Great to have you. Let's begin with Jon Stewart's new movie. It's called Irresistible. It stars Rose Byrne and Steve Carell.
Democrats are getting their asses kicked.
We need some way to road test a more rural-friendly message.
Colonel Jack Hastings is our key back into the great now swing state of Wisconsin.
But I would like to offer my services.
Can we quiet the cows, please?
To help him run for mayor, Dear Larkin.
All right, Christy. A quick synopsis of what this movie is about.
So Steve Carell is a longtime Democratic political hand who failed to help shepherd Hillary Clinton into the White House. So licking his wounds, he tries to reestablish himself by taking over creating actually a campaign for Chris Cooper to run for mayor of a small town in Wisconsin. He is a veteran, a Marine veteran, and a widower who becomes a viral sensation with this video that gets posted of him making a stirring speech at a town council meeting. So he brings his big city Washington elite flashy chops to small town folksy Wisconsin, and Rose Byrne is his counterpart on the Republican side, and she's sort of a Kellyanne Conway figure. And it's supposed to be this indictment of like big money and out of touch coastal elite power as far as dictating what happens in the heartland. And it's about how, you know, people on the coast don't care about real people, but the movie itself doesn't really care about real people either. It's empty and sanctimonious and toothless. And it tamps down all those interesting, incisive instincts that Jon Stewart has had for so long. I don't know what happened here, but it's not that funny and it's not that biting.
Oh, my gosh. What happened to Jon Stewart? I'm dismayed. Justin, did you feel the same way?
I felt exactly the same way as Christy. And as someone who, like a lot of us, I'm sure, have missed Jon Stewart, although, of course, he hasn't been exactly out of the public eye. He's been on Stephen Colbert. You know, his advocacy on behalf of 9/11 first responders and their families has all been very powerful. I say this as someone who liked his first feature he directed, Rosewater, which was more of a straightforward drama about 6 years ago. There's something about movie satire that I think really eludes him. And the generous reading of this movie is that he's trying to make a Frank Capra style, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, corny, but stirring embrace of small town idealism in conflict with DC politics. But exactly as Christy says, the movie doesn't really care about these characters. I mean, it kind of wants you to think it does in terms of the salt of the earth folks of this Wisconsin town. It doesn't really give them any characters to play. It doesn't give them any politics to speak of. The movie is trying to be somewhat bipartisan by saying that, no, the problem isn't really anyone's political differences. The problem is all the money that's in politics. I happen to really disagree very strongly with that. But even if you agree with it, I just think, it's incredibly toothless. And sanctimonious is a good word, too, because I think this movie is sort of trying to be an indictment of out-of-touchness, and the movie itself feels very out of touch.
Wow, that is shocking. It makes you want to go back and watch all of the Veeps instead.
Yes. Much better.
All right, moving on to Disclosure. This is a documentary about the history of transgender representation across media, in film, TV, etc. And here is some of the trailer.
According to a study from GLAAD, 80% of Americans don't actually personally know someone who is transgender. So most of the information that Americans get about who transgender people are, what our lives are and are about, comes from the media.
We've been around since there was footage. You just have to look for us.
All right, Justin, what did you think of this?
I thought this was a really good and insightful and strong, valuable documentary about transgender representation, lack thereof, throughout the entire history of film. And that is, of course, changing for the better. But as we see more accurate, more positive representations of transgender people, but it's someone says something very interesting in the course of the movie. I think it's Jen Richards, who's one of the transgender people who are speaking in, who are interviewed in the film. And she says that every transgender person's understanding of what it means to be transgender has been shaped by the representations that there are, because there are so few and have historically been so few positive ones. And it's like, you could say isn't that true of all of us? You know, we are all shaped by representations. Yes. But it's like, when there are so few to start with, it's that much more impactful.
Right. Right. Yeah. Christy, what did you think?
It is totally fascinating and it's eye opening and it will make you rethink so much of what you have consumed over the years in terms of television and film, high to low, everything from The Silence of the Lambs to Bosom Buddies and everything in between.
Buddies with Tom Hanks.
Oh, right, yeah. But they actually looked to Bosom Buddies as like an insightful depiction of what women and what trans women have to go through to get things like jobs and housing. I mean, it's surprisingly insightful and one of the more sympathetic portrayals. But as Justin was saying, it's looking at everything from a good and a bad perspective, and it's almost dizzying. It's almost like so thorough. It's like it's almost too much to get your head wrapped around in one sitting, in one film. Besides people like Chaz Bono and Laverne Cox, who are some of the more high-profile trans figures out there, you have a lot of behind-the-scenes folks and people who have worked on shows like Transparent or Orange is the New Black or Pose, and they talk about how they felt seeing transgender portrayals throughout their lives and how maybe they had like a fascination or a repulsion or a sadness, you know, something like Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, or The Crying Game, rather, you know, and how so frequently it's so easy to vilify a trans character as scary or other or predatory.
But and they do bring up a lot of great movies, including some on screen who say, I love this movie, and yet it is problematic and even destructive, like something like Psycho or The Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill. And it's like, and a lot of these things reinforce this narrative that transgender people are either threatening killers or they exist to be killed. I mean, the disproportionate number of transgender people who are portrayed as sex workers, for example. And of course, you know, there are transgender sex workers, but it's like, it's just extremely out of proportion to all the many roles and jobs that transgender people can play.
Yeah. It is really interesting to look at it through the lens of violence and how often these characters are portrayed, even sympathetically, as you say, as objects of violence, and how that warps your view of it if you are trans, as to who you are and your value in the culture.
Yeah. And I think it comes also from these characters are usually or have often been subjugated even in the films that they are in. The movie points to, say, Jared Leto's Oscar-winning performance in Dallas Buyers Club, a very acclaimed performance, but, you know, who existed pretty much to, was sort of like the trans savior to Matthew McConaughey's character in that movie. And Matthew McConaughey was the one who was redeemed and saved, and Jared Leto's character died. So that opens up a whole nother avenue of inquiry about what happens when you have cisgender people playing transgender people, and how that just the way that that also reinforces unfortunate narratives and just deprives trans people of work and of representation in their own stories.
Okay, let's end on a silly movie. This is called Eurovision and it stars Will Ferrell. Here's a clip.
Ever since we were children, we've had one dream.
Winning
the Eurovision Song Contest.
Officially, Fire Saga
will be representing Iceland at Eurovision this year.
I hate them.
Absolutely terrible.
They're old, disgusting people.
But we have no choice.
So we're in.
All right, Christy, what is this about?
Oh, man, this is about so much, and it's 2 hours and 3 minutes long. Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams are longtime childhood friends with these delusional dreams of Eurovision grandeur. Eurovision, of course, is the international singing competition, which is a huge deal all over the world, not so much here in the United States. And it's over the top and it's campy, but there's an earnestness to it and also a political element quite frequently to the performances. So they are a duo known as Fire Saga. And they get into Eurovision, although they're terrible, and they compete against all the other countries. And it's about how they find their voice, but they also bicker. It's basically a traditional Will Ferrell role of a big, oafish, but, you know, adorable man-child. Very similar to the character he played in Blades of Glory. This is a Will Ferrell character that you know. This actually was shot during Eurovision quite a bit in 2019. If you are a fan of it, you will see cameos from people who have won over the years. And it's got this kind of uneasy balance of making fun of how ridiculous and outlandish and just kitschy Eurovision is, but also embracing it as an international celebration of talent and love and joy. And they never quite find that balance. Also, this could be a tight 85, 90-minute film and would have been so much better. It dragged.
Everything really, really is in excess. Everything. Okay, Justin, what did you think?
I don't disagree with anything Christy said. I just think I enjoyed it anyways a lot more than she did. I think this movie works better dramatically than comedically, which is such a weird thing to say. I know, it sounds ridiculous. But I think that the movie is not even, to me, trying to make fun of Eurovision so much because it already knows that Eurovision exists in a realm beyond self-parody. You know, it is already a parody of itself and a knowing one. And so the movie embraces a lot of that, the ritual, the excess, the flamboyance of the endeavor. And it sort of reminded me a little bit, I'm not saying a qualitative comparison, but if you think about like Christopher Guest's mockumentaries like A Mighty Wind, for example, where there's so much love for what it's satirizing that it isn't even a satire anymore. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, periodically, I got that sense, you know, there's this sing-off in the movie midway through where it's just like this like long tracking shot and it becomes this huge medley and everyone's singing and Dan Stevens is singing and Rachel McAdams is singing. And at a certain point, I sort of stopped laughing about it and I just kind of got swept up. And I think the music is pretty catchy.
Really? Because everything is like, really? about this movie.
On Justin's point, the songs come from like this really well-established songwriter who did like Love Me Like You Do by Ellie Goulding and Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd. And he's a really well-known pop songwriter. And so that's why the songs are actually good. I've had Volcano Man stuck in my head for so long. And when you see this movie, you will know why. It's the first song in the film. It is the biggest laugh out loud moment in the film when they're playing their song in Iceland on the fjords. Anyway, it's got a lot of moments.
Well, maybe Fire Saga will go on tour for real once this pandemic is over. And, you know, kind of like Spinal Tap did.
They will bring us all together.
Yes. Fire Saga. As our saviors. Excellent. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on today. Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Justin Chang reviews films for the LA Times. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. Thanks, Christy.
That does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Kaylee Wells. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our technical directors. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast. Listen wherever, whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. Have a great weekend, whatever you do. Maybe singing a little bit in Icelandic. Who knows? I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you on Monday.